On the phone I have Dr. Bruce Lipton, who has written the profoundly popular book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter and Miracles. The story of our cells, in particular the cells wanting to burst into a higher level of being. With recommendations from Joseph Chilton Pierce, the author of Crack in the Cosmic Egg and the Magical Child, Carl Pilbram, Professor Emeritus of Stanford University with his theory that memory may be stored in our brain as if in a hologram, to Greg Braden, the author of The God Code. Now academics globally in growing numbers are reading this book and igniting within themselves an inner awareness that we are much greater than who we think we are, that we are at a deeper subatomic level, energy bundles of exponential potential, and it is only in these last few moments of Earth time that we have realized that we are the answer we have been searching for. Kia ora. Good morning, Bruce.
Well, good morning. Gosh, it's just a wonderful hope that you provided, that we're going somewhere, and I so believe that.
Yes, Bruce, I agree. And reading your book, it just propelled me into poetic license, and I trust by not allowing too much hyperbole to influence me. So, Bruce, where did it all start?
Well, for me, it was an interesting transformation that occurred one evening, in fact, after years and years of research in cell biology. My work actually was cloning stem cells, and it's interesting because people think stem cells are something relatively recent. My first cultures of stem cells, I did those back in 1967, so that was about 40 years ago, and yet the very interesting fact is, as we see through stem cells, they provide us with great insights about how life comes from cells and how cells and life and the environment are very much intertwined. So just very quickly, I was growing my cells, and when you clone cells, you start with a single cell in a petri dish. You isolate that cell, and then what you do is you let it divide, so it then it forms two cells, and then they divide, and then you get 4 and 8 and 16, and pretty soon you have 1,000 cells. But what's interesting, all the cells are genetically identical because they came from the same cell. But what blew my mind was, in my early research, I started to split up this community of identical cells like into three different petri plates. And by changing the environment, by changing the conditions of the medium that I grew the cells in, that in plate one, I could have the cells form muscle, and change the environment in plate two, and they form bone cells, or change the environment in plate three with changing the constituents, and they form fat cells. And all of a sudden, I mean, it just hit me. It said, here we are talking about, and I was teaching medical students at that same time, the dogma, the belief genes control life. And yet my experiments revealed, look, these are all genetically identical cells in the three petri dishes, and they form different things. So the question just comes up and says, well, what controlled the cells? And the answer is, well, they were all genetically identical. The only thing that was different was the environment. And then it hit me. It's like, oh, my God. Cells respond to the environment, not pre-programmed inside like we teach right now, that as you change the environment, I could take my cells and put them in a healthy environment, and they flourish and they grow, and then take the very same cells and alter the environment to a less supportive environment, a more toxic environment. And what would happen is these cells would start to get sick and they would die, and then take them out of that environment, put them back into into a good environment, and all of a sudden they became healthy again. So while we keep looking at disease and sickness as something that was programmed from the inside, the new biology reveals that our life is a reflection of the environment that we live in. And if we disturb or destroy the environment, we will then kill ourselves, which we are doing. And that why this becomes important is, very simply, the old story, the one that's being taught in school right now, in fact, is we are victims because genes control our lives, and we didn't pick the genes, and we can't change the genes, and therefore we're more or less helpless as genes run where we go. That's a belief system. Now the new science reveals, no, it's the environment, or how we see the environment, what we believe about the environment, that's what controls ourselves. Well, the importance is this. The first case, when genes control it, you're a victim. But if perceptions and beliefs and attitudes control it, then all of a sudden you start to see, well, then we become very powerful because we can change our beliefs and attitudes. We can't change the genes, but if we can change how we see the world, and when we do that, there's a profound change in the biology. And what we have to do is really, as you talked about in the introduction, is we better radically change our beliefs about how we're living on this planet, because the way we've created the environment is toxic and is causing disease in the population.
Yes, this is extremely powerful. And how are you putting out the message, Bruce? You've got the book, you're touring the world, you're...
Well, it's fortunate because I'm not the maker of this change. I got into the game real early. I was a pioneer 40 years ago seeing this revolutionary change. The revolutionary change is now being manifest by more and more scientists. We've reached the critical point where now this information is coming out from the scientific world and very quickly coming into the public world. Just for example, last month, Discover Magazine, which popularizes science, had an article called The New Genetics, DNA is Not Your Identity. And it's all about this new science of, which is basically epigenetics. Let's define a word for the audience. What we teach in school right now and what people are very familiar with is called genetic control, which literally says control by genes. The new science is called epigenetic control. And the prefix epi means above, like epidermis means above the dermis. Well, epi is above. So you say epigenetic control, that says control above the genes. And all of a sudden we enter into this magical world, which is changing lives everywhere when we start to empower people with the fact that they're not victims, but they have powers above the genes. You can make yourself well, you can make yourself sick. Either way, it's just really on how you interact with the world.
So with the world at present, of course, we've got many, many, many people, particularly, say, in Africa and in the Middle East, of course, who are very challenged. How do we get these ideas through? Have you any...
The hardest part is we have to recognize that the ideas that by which we live our lives are programmed into... Remember, you see, it's our interaction with the environment that controls the genes. Well, our interactions with the environments are our experiences and our beliefs, how we see the world. That's how we impact our genes. Just to let you know, to give an example of... If you have a misperception, it could kill you. So I'll give you an example. You take an anorexic person, and everyone looks at this person, their skin and bones, and horrified that this person is near death. And yet, we see that, but we ask the anorexic person to look in the mirror and explain what they see, and what they see is this bloated person. And the reality is that because that's the perception, if that's the way that person sees themselves, they will send information from their brain to their body and adjust their genes and their biology to get thinner and thinner and thinner, even while everyone else around can see that this person is so skinny they're going to die. The individual can't. That's a misperception. They are seeing the world incorrectly and as a result destroying their biology. So the point is there wasn't anything physically wrong with this person. It was just that their mind was converting that image into an effort to get thinner because the image was distorted. What does this mean? If we see the world in a distorted point of view, then we will adjust our biology and create something to complement what we perceive. So now I go back and you say, well, what do we do about it? And the answer is this: all of us, everywhere, as children, we're programmed with beliefs even before we were born. The fetus is already downloading information about the environment. So, for example, if you play music to a baby as it's developing, when that baby is born, you play that music, the child will instantly recognize it and respond to it, or the father's voice doing that through the abdomen. And then when the baby's born, the father opens his mouth, says the words, the baby knows exactly which one the father is. So the point is, even as a fetus, we start to acquire beliefs. Well, here's the problem. If we believe we live in a threatening world, we change our biology to make us more effective as combatants. And yet there's a cost for that. And the cost is you take away, because when you live in this stress level, you're taking away the ability to regenerate your body and to nourish it fully, because you're conserving your energy like a resource to spring and run from whatever the threat is. So you compromise your health. Well, point is, all of us grow up in a world with these threats and fears. But like in the Middle East or in other countries, these beliefs are propagated from generation to generation. So the war in the Middle East is actually the belief that has been propagated for 1,000 years from generation to generation. So today's children are fighting the same beliefs and war that their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents started a long time ago. What we need to do? We have to start getting an education out earlier and earlier to children of a different way of life in a different world, because that's the only way to break the pattern. And then recognize that you and I and everyone listening has already been programmed themselves by beliefs that are very limiting and detrimental. The beliefs of aging, that's a belief right there. And this is why when you understand the nature of beliefs, you can understand why people would like a terminal cancer change their belief and then have what's called a spontaneous remission. Or those patients where doctors have written them off saying, well, there's no way you will ever heal this, whatever it is. And then that person heals themselves. We call it a miracle. And really, it's science in the sense that it was the mind of the individual sending more positive directive orders to heal themselves than the hopes that, or the lack of hope given by the doctor at that point. So we have to recognize that everyone in the world has been pre-programmed from this early age, fetal age through six, the primary age. And whatever those beliefs are, they will shape our biology through the rest of our lives. So we really have to start looking at some very more effective, healthful, supportive, congruent beliefs that will keep us alive in this world that's being threatened right now.
Yes, Bruce, because we've got trillions of cells in our body. So what happens inside to get them enthused to want to be healthy and young and vital and vibrant?
Well, the first thing is this. There's something that biologists cannot explain. They can identify, but they can't explain, and it's called the biological imperative. And the biological imperative, what does that mean? It means this, that any organism on this planet, be it the simplest of the bacterial cells or the most complex human or whatever you want, has a built-in desire to survive, which is unexplainable in the system. You can't see it. It doesn't show up anywhere. That if you threaten the life of a bacterium, it will engage in every maneuver possible to itself to stay alive. If you chase a rat and it runs away as best as it possibly can, but if the rat gets cornered, to stay alive, it will actually turn on you and attack you. And what does this mean? It means it's like, there's something biologically built in to sustain life, and every cell has that built into it. And what's really interesting is we're having trouble living in a world where there's 6.5 billion people on this planet, and we're destroying the environment, destroying the planet, we're destroying each other. And yet, here's an interesting fact, what people don't recognize, and that is, as you mentioned, well, we see the human body as a singular entity. I look in the mirror, I see Bruce looking back at me, single person, an individual. That's not really a correct understanding, because here's the fact. Every body, as you mentioned, is made out of upwards to like 50 trillion cells. It's the cells that are individual living entities. We, when we say that word myself, is really a community of 50 trillion cells living in harmony. Every cell is a sentient living organism. It's got intelligence and consciousness. That's why I was able to grow the cells and tissue culture out of a human body, take cells out of the body and grow them. And as you mentioned in the beginning, the heart cells from that chicken from the experiments from 100 or more years ago, the cells can grow without you. They're intelligent. And yet, what does it mean is if you look inside the human body, then you're actually seeing a community of like individual tiny people, that each cell is this individual entity that wants to survive. And here's the point. There are 50 trillion citizens that live inside a human body. They have a community. They have jobs. They share the equivalent of money in the form of energy. The cells that work harder get more energy, and there's a pay scale and all this. And what's the point? Every cell gets health care. Every cell gets food delivered to it. Every cell is assured that it can sleep at night because the environment is protected by an immune system. That it's a cooperating functional world of 50 trillion individuals. And what the point is here we are. We can't get along with 6.5 billion people, and yet underneath our skin is a world of individuals that have an exchange and a work system and a work ethic and a desire for life. And so if you feel, you know, elation or ecstasy in your biology, you have to realize that 50 trillion individual citizens are feeling exactly the same thing. And then you look at our world and say, can you imagine our world all feeling in a state of bliss and ecstasy that the human body can experience? The answer is, it could do that if it followed the rules of exactly how those 50 trillion cells do live in harmony. And the interesting joy to me about it is that for 1,000 years, people have said, the answers lie within. Seek the answers within. And the fact is, my goodness, absolutely true. Why? There are 50 trillion citizens that have learned how to live in harmony, that have learned through technology to create a healthy environment under the skin, clearing the air, the fluids, the water, and cleaning it up and you know, healing the system. And it's like, my God, the lessons that are available to us if we realize that, yes, cells are sentient individuals, and they learn how to live in community, how to share and how to manage and how to create an economy that supports that life. The lessons for us are right there. Our future is to look inside the human body and recognize, well, how do people or cells in this particular case, you know, live? What are their jobs? How do they exchange energy? How do they share awareness? How do they protect themselves? Like, the answers are there. And they've been there in the sense that the human body has been here for millions of years. It says, well, that community of cells learned how to create an environment that has sustained them for millions of years, and we on this world are destroying ourselves so quickly that we should say, what are those simple rules? And the joy about it is simply this, is that whatever it takes for a human to live, those are the things that cells need to live, because we are cells. So if we model ourselves after the cells that make up our body, we will have the greatest opportunity to survive in health and thrive on this planet rather than be in crisis as we are.
So we humans are taxis for advanced cells to go around in style?
Well, exactly, and to learn from their lessons, in fact. So, but you have to realize that you are a community, that your thoughts and your beliefs and your emotions and all that are the action of 50 trillion individual entities contributing to you. You are, in a sense, the spirit of these 50 trillion cells. You are the energy, the field, the source, the information, the individuality that is represented by the cells in your body. They represent you. You are them. That there's this interplay between your identity as information and what Lynn McTaggart writes about, called the field or the invisible forces around us. And it's interesting because quantum physics regards this field or invisible forces as controlling life, and they talk about these invisible moving forces. And the funny part is, this is the same definition that people have defined spirit by for 1,000 or more years, as an invisible moving force that gives shape to our world. And now physicists are recognizing the fact that what they have called the field is this invisible moving force. So whether you call it invisible moving forces, quantum field, or spirit, it reveals that there's something outside of us that gives shape to our bodies and our communities, and have a dialogue with this community so that our thoughts dialogue with ourselves and ourselves dialogue back to our thoughts.
In many ways, there's 6.5 billion of us. We're energy fields within the biosphere.
Yes. In fact, in evolution, it's funny because evolution, it goes in jumps. The first evolution is the evolution of a single cell. In fact, 3 billion years on this planet, there was nothing more than single cells. Amoebas, paramecia, algae, yeast, bacteria, that's all there was. And only 700 million years ago, the cells started to come together because and form communities. That was the evolutionary jump. The bacteria, the cells, they didn't necessarily evolve. What evolved was the organization of cells, and they formed these communities. Some communities evolved and had a shape like a starfish. So we call a starfish an organism. No, it's a community of cells that have a shape like a starfish, or a cat, or a human. And we're communities of cells. But the interesting thing is, just like when the cells got evolved as far as they could evolve, their next level of evolution didn't make a better cell, it made a community of cells. Well, parallel, humans evolved as individuals, and then at some point started to realize that the evolution of the individual human, well, that sort of reached what it does. But the next level of evolution was to come together and form a community of humans, just like cells came together and form a community that now we call a human being. Communities of humans come together, and in such a community, we are like cells in a larger evolution called humanity. Well, this is the next big evolutionary step. This is what we're on the bridge of right now. You mentioned it in your introduction. We are on the bridge of owning. We are not just a collection of individual people. All of the people represent a larger entity. We are like a giant multicellular organism, and it's called humanity. Humanity is evolving, not the human. And so we are now in a very important transition in our own evolution. Humanity is evolving from the current character to a more advanced character, which is not a physical change. It's a change of awareness. We are becoming evolving from what you might call a state of being reptiles, which are conscious organisms. Reptiles are conscious. They live at the moment. They don't see the future. They're just here. And we're evolving into mammals, and mammals are different because they're self-conscious, meaning they're aware of themselves and their piece in the bigger picture. And as a result, mammals become nurturers because they say, well, if I take care of this, I take care of myself. Reptiles are not nurturers, they're just users. Whatever is there, they'll use, and they'll rape and pillage whatever they have to do. They eat their own young, you know. And what we're evolving into is a stage of our human evolution from a reptilian type character to a mammalian character. And it's not a coincidence or a joke. It's a reality that it's interesting that the fuel of our humanity, the fuel of our society, is oil. And the significance is oil is the blood of the dinosaurs. And now we're peaking on the blood of the dinosaurs, forcing us to evolve past that. And we are actually entering into this nurturing stage. And an interesting reality is that the seed of this nurturing stage was germinated in 1969 on a very specific event. The seed of that was derived from the moment that man landed on the moon and took a picture of the Earth off into the distance of the moon. And we saw it as this little blue-green gem suspended in the darkness. And it finally dawned on us from that perspective, this is all there is. And in 1969, around the hippie time and all that, the idea was seeded. They said, oh, my God, this is all there is. We better take care of the land, and we better take care of the water, and we better take care of the air, and we better take care of the children. And the interesting fact is taking care is nurturing. That's what it means. And nurturing is the character of mammals. So in 1969, the concept of nurturing, being a mammal to the planet, entered into our psyche. And it's taken years for that seed to develop further to the extent that it is finally evident now that there's a reality is, yes, you're either going to be part of the mammal and be nurturers, because the dinosaurs, the reptile point of view, the George Bushes of the world, that's the epitome of a dinosaur, is hopefully on its last legs. And it didn't just give away to the mammals. The dinosaurs didn't just give up. They fought to the end, but in the end, the meek inherited the earth. And when you look at the dinosaurs and the mammals, which were at the same time, the mammals were the meek, and the dinosaurs, these ferocious entities, just couldn't sustain themselves, and they died off. And so it becomes relevant to see that we are advancing into this new form. And for me, a joy is to be here in New Zealand, because New Zealand does not have to go through that entire dinosaur stage if it sees where it goes, and by learning from the errors of the big dinosaur of the United States, that to maintain the environment, to maintain the nature of the community of people, this is what has killed the United States. That the people do not mean much in a world based where industry and business is more important than the person. So in other words, the dinosaur got so big that it was the industry or business world that became much more important than a person would ever be, because it was the interest of that entity that overrose the interest of the people that make up the community. And what's really nice about New Zealand is that it's still based in a large part on the nature of the individual member of the community itself, and that if you don't give up your freedom of that to corporate interests, you have the power to stay alive much longer and thrive, while the dinosaur nations like the United States are going to have a severe crisis coming up right now, because evolution means the fall of one system and the rise of another system, and we're facing it right now. And science has told us that this is not a joke, this is a crisis, that by 2048, the oceans will be fished out. I mean, for me, that concept alone was like, I could see down the road in the future this might be a possibility, but down the road in the future is less than 40 years. That healthcare issues are destroying the world, most especially in places like the United States, which again says, learn from this. What's the issue? The stresses of that world, through the perception of the individual, which is what we started the whole conversation about, it's how you see the world that determines your health. If you live in that stressful environment, it will actually destroy your health. 90% of cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, coronaries, all those things like that, 90% of that is totally attributable to lifestyle, meaning if you live in a world like that, that is a natural consequence. And if you get out of a world like that, you can restore your heart. So just like I take the cells and put my petri dish in a good environment, they grow, put them in a bad environment, they get sick, take them out of the bad environment, return them to the good environment, they heal and regenerate. Well, look at the reality of this. We are skin-covered petri dishes. We got a petri dish with 50 trillion cells inside of us, and if we move our petri dish into a good environment, we thrive. But if you take that same petri dish and put it in a less supportive environment, it will toxify and start to get disease. So the lessons are very obvious, and yet what we have to own is this evolution that says let go of that reptilian version of a struggle for the fittest world, that Darwinian belief we bought into, and start to recognize that life evolves through cooperation, not competition. That's what evolution was all about, cooperation. Every organism in the environment is cooperating with every other organism to create that environment. And we're the only ones in this planet that are not cooperative members of the organism called the biosphere and Gaia.
Yes, I guess you can see that when a lion takes a zebra down, the lion has its fill, then comes the hyena, then the jackal, and then after the jackal, you might have a buzzard and crows, and then finally you get right down to ants, and then
bacteria at the very bottom.
That's right, and they all found their niches within the system. It's very profound, because in New Zealand, of course, we're lucky. We've built on cooperation. We had most of our farms in New Zealand were cooperatives. We had cooperative meatworks. We had cooperative banks, particularly trust banks, all up and down the country once upon a time. We also had mutual insurance companies everywhere. We have hotels that were based on trust too. And at the end of the year, the profits would equally sort of divided out amongst the community, the Red Cross, the Surf Life Saving, crippled children, etc. We have actually a cooperative country, and even our trees in New Zealand are very interesting. They don't have a deep tap root like other trees. They actually have a small sort of bowl root, but they all cluster together in a cluster, and as a result, when the wind hits this whole cluster of trees, the wind goes over the top and the trees stay in the ground. But if you have that one tree standing out alone and the wind comes, it'll just pull it out by its roots. So we have this inbred stuff, and to the degree I saw some sheep being mustered, and a whole lot of sheep were going down the road, and one fell over, and all of a sudden a lot of the other sheep came back and started clustering around this sheep, looking at this sheep. And I thought, wow, this is so wonderful. Sheep do care for their kin. And then the shepherd came along and actually picked up this sheep, and it happened to walk, and they walked away, and everybody was happy. And so there is this wonderful sort of field of cooperation here.
That's what the entire world was based on to begin with. And it's interesting because some explorers recently went to New Guinea, to an area that had never been explored by anybody. So it was like pristine. And they were like helicoptered in. And when they started to move around, almost all the wild animals of the forest came up to them. And the reality was, because the forest had always been in this giant community in the first place. And so since they hadn't learned to fear humans yet, then when they were dropped into this place, there's biological organisms, all the other organisms are very curious. They came right up to them. And the significance was, until we changed who we were in the relationship to the planet, when we became the dominator of nature in our belief system, that separated us from the community of nature. And so we live in a world where all living organisms that know us will flee as fast as they can if they see us coming. And yet, in a world they don't know us, we become incorporated as part of the community. And so, in the reality was, the concept of a Garden of Eden, is not totally an outside fantastical idea. It was actually primarily the nature of how we even came into the environment through this community. We were part of the community. But unfortunately, it's interesting, the two major institutions that really provide direction for humanity, the church and science, both of them make us separate from that environment. The church says, of course, that we were put on top of this and all this was just for us, that we weren't here, and then all of a sudden you were just laid down in this garden. No, we evolved through this garden. And science does it in the other way. It says, well, everything is an individual, independent unit, that survival of the fittest. And it turns out when you focus on the fittest, meaning the individuals, you miss the picture, because evolution is not based on the fittest. Nature doesn't really care what any individual human does. What nature cares is, what does the effect of the collective actions of humans? And as nature is recognized, we are destructive of the environment, and as a equivalent of a pathogen that gets into a human body, the human body will shake that pathogen and destroy it and get it out to create harmony again. That the earth, in a sense, is trying to get rid of us, because we are destroying its harmony. And so that, again, returns back to getting back to that land, getting back to the community, And restoring harmony. And it's very interesting because the things you talked about in the communal nature of New Zealand, in fact, just the moments ago I was reading correspondence online which are talking about that the United States is clearly on a collision course with a crisis. It's not just the United States crisis. It's a world crisis where the United States is going to manifest at first, and it's going to be an economic disaster. And it's interesting because what I just read was the fact that there are places like in Germany and other places around the world reinstituting community banking, which you brought up before, which feeds and sustains and supports the community, because in the crisis that's impending, it will only be community that will sustain and allow life to thrive. And so it wasn't that long ago in New Zealand where apparently, as you said, all this was part of a way of life, and so it can come back a lot easier than in other places where this has been gone for hundreds or more years. So this is why I think it's interesting that Edgar Cayce, the prophet guy, the sleeping prophet, I think they called him, and Buckminster Fuller, the futurist of the world, both of these individuals very specifically said New Zealand would be the like the reference point for the rest of the world. That people will see life in New Zealand and use that as a guide to return the stability to the environment after the crises both of them said will happen. So for me, it's a joy because I come out of that other system and I land in New Zealand and I say, oh, my God, this is it. This is what you want. You want to maintain this. This nature of this community, because this is what keeps a body alive. The cells maintain the community. Remember I said our perceptions or our beliefs are the information that control the cells. When our beliefs are like a bad government where we keep sending messages to these 50 trillion cells, life is scary, life won't work, or I'm not good enough, or all these kinds of thoughts that we put into our community, you have to realize there are 50 trillion citizens that are listening to your thoughts. These are your cells. If you had to listen every day to the one radio station, and every day there was some tyrant on that radio station telling you that life is troublesome and hard and you're going to, you know, struggle and fight, there'd be a point where, as a member of the community, you say, I just don't want to put up with this stuff anymore. And then you pull out of the community. Well, this is exactly what cancer is all about. Cancer is where your 50 trillion cells have been listening to some anger that generally builds up in the system for years and years and years and years. At some point, they say, I don't want to listen to that anymore. And cancer is when cells pull out of the nature of community. And when they pull out of the nature of community, where every cell is out for themselves saying, well, who cares? I don't want to be part of that group. That's death to the system. That's the story. The internal story and the external stories are both one and the same. So when we destroy our environment, we become less healthy, we destroy ourselves. And these are the lessons that cells offer us, and the simplicity of how life can actually be a wonderful coexistence of trillions of citizens. And as we said, we can't even do it with a few billion.
Yes, are you familiar with Dorothy Retallick's book, this Sound of Music and Plants, where she had these plants and she bombarded them, one with classical, one with, I think it was Ravi Shankar, and another one with underground acid rock. And of course, what happened was that the plant with the classical music, I think it was Bach, long roots, and Ravi Shankar had fairly long roots too, but the underground acid rock had extremely stunted roots, and it sort of told the story of possibly what's happening again with our culture today. We've been bombarded by sound vibrations that are stunting our growth.
Not just sound vibrations. See, this is what the new exciting biology is all about, and what I write about in the book especially, is that the old world, the belief of Newtonian world, it means a philosophy that all that's important are physical things, like gears engaging each other, and that so we focus on the material world. quantum physics, which replaced Newtonian physics as the fundamental mechanisms of how the universe works, actually says that was an error, that because everything that we see that's physical is itself actually vibrational energy. There, if I gave you a camera and said I could allow you to fly through an atom and I want you to shoot all the sights that you see, go through the atom and shoot a million pictures, come out the other side, and let's take a look at what the atom looks like, we would develop that film. And it's interesting because when you fly through the atom and took all the pictures, you realize there is nothing physical inside an atom. The belief of little marbles and ball bearings like electrons and protons and neutrons, that's an imagination. The reality is those equivalents of protons and neutrons, electrons, they're actually like little invisible energy tornadoes, like just actually like little tiny tornadoes of force. The point is that the atom is not made out of physical matter, it's made out of vibrational forces. And the influence of all the vibrations in the environment impact each other, just like you can go up and down a piano keyboard and have chords that resonate with each other. The electromagnetic spectrum, the vibrational field, is like this giant keyboard. And at any level, you can play a chord of vibrations at one level, which are harmonic or resonant to vibrational chords at different levels, so that we, as humans, are affected by all ranges of vibrations, from cell phone vibrations to radar to microwaves to sound that we talked about to color, and so that we actually have to recognize that this vibrational field is shaping matter. And this is a point that Einstein made, and it's so simple. That's why I just love it. Einstein made it so simple and so powerful in one phrase. He said, "The sole governing agency of the particle is the field. And the field is the invisible energy. The particle is matter." It's that the sole governing agency of matter is this invisible field. Well, that's what you talked about in regard to the plants, that the sound vibrations, the invisible, but their vibrations alter matter. Now we find that all levels of fields alter matter to different degrees. And so the pollution in the field is disturbing the organisms and everything that grows. I think there was a wonderful study where they found that the sounds of crickets and the night sounds that you hear and the birds and all these sounds actually make a little symphony of sound. And they found that if they played to plants in a field, the same, you know, through speakers, a recording of all these sounds, of natural sounds, that these plants grew healthier than plants that were not in that sound field. So again, it supports the same thing. We're in a large orchestra, and yet our belief system as humans is we're just individual pieces in a large pile of other pieces, when in fact is no, we are an integral unit of a large community of integral units at all levels of the visible and the invisible world that we live in right now.
Yes, so we're an energy field in a greater universal energy field.
Yes, and our energy fields influence things around us, so our thoughts become not just the new biology emphasizes very specifically how the vibration of thought comes into the body, and that vibration, like a broadcast, causes the cells to respond to it. Like this, the cells, as I said, are like listening to a radio show, which is our mind, and that's the only station they get. And whatever vibrations we send, they respond to them. We send them threatening vibrations, they get in a protection mode, which shuts off their growth, or we can send them vibrations of love and harmony, which cause them to flourish. So our minds send thoughts in, but we now also know, using recording devices, we can read that our brain activity is not restricted to our heads, that our brain activity is actually broadcast out into this field. So each one of us, each one of us using our thoughts and our mind are contributing to this giant symphony. If you start to realize it, you have to say, well, what are we broadcasting here, acid rock or Ravi Shankar? And the response will be whatever thoughts that we're sending out, either of those two directions, for example.
Yes, and of course the heart comes into it as a big one. If a family, if people are born into a family where they're loving relationships, it just then, that's where we start to really make a difference.
Well, that's what we started with. You know, we talked about how are we going to make a difference. The answer is by recognizing that what we are unknowingly have been programming into a child shapes that child's life, but also since that child is a contributor to a larger community, then what we teach our children is also influencing the unfoldment of that community that children participate in, which we are now participants of, considering that we were programmed as children, and those beliefs we brought forward and are shaping our world with those beliefs right now, that it becomes important to put a much more harmonious belief into a child. This programmable aspect, I just think of the humor of it, because it was the Jesuits are very proud of this. They make a statement that says, you give us a child until it's 6 or 7, and it will belong to the church for the rest of its life. What they really recognized was this: if you give the fundamental programming by 6 or 7, whatever programming that is, for the rest of the life of that child, no matter what their individual minds might want them to do, that programming will shape them for the rest of their lives. So that was a recognition, yes, the first 6 years are the most important.
Yes, yes. Well, Bruce, we've got 2 minutes. Now, you also said that you were an agnostic prior to. Now, all of a sudden, there's been a spiritual awakening. In the last 1 minute, 30 seconds, can you make a flurry?
Well, basically, as I said, there's a relationship between the field, the invisible forces, and matter. As Einstein said, the field shapes matter. And I started to recognize that what makes each one of us different as a human being, why each human is not the same, which you medically can test, because if I graft my organ or tissue into your body, you'll reject it. You graft your tissue's or organ into somebody else's body, they'll reject it, because bodies know self. So I said, well, what's the self? And it turns out the self is defined by a set of antennas, just like television antennas on the surface of the cell, that are tuned to different, like, frequencies or something in the field. The point was, if I cut off the antennas, the cell doesn't have a self. It's generic. And the antennas are receiving some broadcast. So my biology said, oh, my God, yes, there's an identity. I have an identity different from you. But what makes us different is something that's on the outside of the body, not on the inside of the body. And all of a sudden, a guy who was agnostic then all of a sudden started recognizing, oh, my God, it's exactly what Einstein said. It was the field, something out there, which is an invisible moving force, which is then can either be a quantum force or, in other terms, a spiritual force, is what gives shape to my life. And that's what Einstein said. The field, that invisible stuff, gives shape to matter, and all of a sudden science transcends into the realm of spirituality, and now both are saying the same thing, and the merger of the two is actually our salvation.